On behalf of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, let me welcome you to the Virginia Festival of the Book. My name is George Gillum, and I teach Virginia history here in the Corcoran Department of History. I'm going to be moderating this distinguished panel of three outstanding scholars. Today's presentation is made possible by the generous contribution of the Now Center for the Study of the American Civil War History, which is located right here in this very building. I'd like each of you to close your eyes, be very quiet and still, picture the Danube River, and picture a Viking cruise boat sailing down the river just before a very distinguished PBS program. Here to provide a brief educational message about our sponsor is Will Kurtz of the Center.
Thank you, everybody, for being here. Let me just read a brief statement about the Center. The new Center represents the centerpiece of a gift exceeding $13 million that combines our founder, John L. Now III's passion for mid-19th century American history and the University of Virginia. Fueled by his vision to establish UVA as the premier university on mid-19th century American history, the center will allow historians, archivists, and students to deepen and expand our understanding of this critical period of history, which continues to be important today. In addition to the center, Now's gift will support an endowed professorship, a postdoctoral fellowship, scholarship funds, undergraduate internships, and travel funds, and a major book prize. Thank you all for being here.
Today's event is very enticingly titled The Civil War Experienced. And here's what we're going to do. We are limited to only 75 minutes. That's all we could pay for the space for. We want to reserve about 30 minutes at the end for your questions and the author's responses. I'm going to take about 5 minutes to introduce all three speakers at once, and then I'm going to beat a hasty retreat. And then each of the three presenters will have not more than 1 second, then 13 minutes of opening comments. And then we'll take questions from the audience. And in that connection, I'd like to remind those who would like to ask questions or make comments, God gave man only one mouth but two ears. There was a reason. Now, the way people, individuals, families experienced the Civil War is really best captured by the stories that they recorded and left. Our first book, Daydreams and Nightmares, A Virginia Family Faces Secession and War, was crafted by Brent Tarter from family letters exchanged during the war. Those letters are now preserved on a reel of microfilm housed in the Library of Virginia. Dr. Tarter, who all of us respect as one of the most productive and prolific historians of Virginia, was the founding editor of the Library of Virginia's multi-volume Dictionary of American Biography, and is the author of numerous books and articles on Virginia's history. I must say that among my favorites on the long shelf of Brent's books is The Grandees of Government, The Origins and Persistence of Undemocratic Politics in Virginia. Our second presentation will be about Excommunicated from the Union, How the Civil War Created a Separate Catholic America, by Dr. William B. Kurtz, who is the digital historian of the Now Center. And while all of your eyes were closed, he was the voice of the Now Center. What initially hooked my interest in his book is his treatment of the unique challenges that Catholic priests confronted practicing a religion with a formal liturgy in the untidy chaos of battlefields. But his book is more than just a story of how priests administered the sacraments on the battlefield. It's a sweeping history of Catholicism in 19th century America. I found an awful lot about it surprising as well as elegantly written. Our third book, actually two big heavy volumes, is by my count the 36th written or edited by Dr. James I. Robertson, Jr., who is the Alumni Distinguished Professor Emeritus in History at Virginia Tech. Scholars have known for 150 years of J.B. Jones' amazing diary maintained during the Civil War, and it's thought to be perhaps the most complete day-to-day account of the war experience in Richmond. Bud Robertson has now masterfully edited and provided context to Jones's diary. It's not only a great read standing alone, but it'll continue to be an extraordinarily rich resource for historians of the war. I and hundreds of thousands of others loved his magisterial Stonewall Jackson, the man, the soldier, the legend, and what I, or we, all of us, loved perhaps even more were his weekly radio broadcasts on NPR with stories from the Civil War. They have cemented Bud Robertson's place as our most beloved Civil War storyteller. So please welcome Brent Tarter, Will Kurtz, and Bud Robertson. Thank you.
My friends who are not historians ask me, what do you do? And I say, well, I read dead people's mail. Or, like Bud, we read their diaries, or we read the newspapers, we read the sermons and speeches they wrote, we read the sermons and speeches they heard, we read their tax returns, we read their will, we read their deeds, we look at their architecture, look at their clothing, and look at their pictures, to try to figure out what they were like, people who lived in a different time and in a different place. This is not a very big book. Took a long time to write, but it was not a very big book to write. And it derives from a collection of family papers. This is a story about a Western Virginia family. Husband and wife got separated at the beginning of the Civil War. It derives from the incomplete exchange of letters that survived during their two long separations. Of course, everybody has a unique experience in life, especially during trying times. And if there were ever trying times, it was the Civil War in North America. I suspect virtually every family either lost a member or knew somebody who had lost a member or had been wounded or had their family disrupted or their farm destroyed during the war. It touched everybody, and it touched everybody differently. What's interesting to me is this family of George and Susan Berlin from Buchanan in Upshur County, which is now West Virginia, had their own unique experiences, but their experiences also shared many large themes with people from north and south, east and west. Their community was divided. Some of their neighbors raised regiments to fight for the United States. Some of their neighbors raised regiments to fight for the Confederacy. George Berlin went from Western Virginia to Richmond in February of 1865 to serve as a member of the Virginia Convention to decide what Virginia should do during the secession crisis. He was elected as an opponent of secession. About two-thirds of the members of the convention were opponents of secession. After the war began, he changed his mind and stayed with Virginia and the South. He went back home to Western Virginia to try to persuade his neighbors and his family to do the same. He got run out of town. He and his wife were separated for another year and a half. George Berlin's brother, Frederick, stayed with the Union. So this is a divided family in a divided community, in a divided border state, in a divided nation. It doesn't get much worse than that. This is a family story. George Berlin and his wife had five children. George's brother was married to his wife Susan's sister, and they had about five children. And her parents and brothers and sisters lived in the next town over. And this story, this drama that they experienced during this long separation at the beginning of the Civil War, involves all of these family members. One of the first things that struck me when I started reading these letters was that, of course, they didn't know what was going to happen. And they continued leading their lives during the secession crisis, during the first months of the war, as if the war was not going to happen. That's one of the hardest things, I think, about writing history, is that we know how it came out. They didn't. So they continued leading their lives as normally as they could. Their focus was on their children, on their brothers and sisters, on her parents who lived not too far away, on planting the potatoes in the spring. George Berlin was going to build a new house. He was a lawyer, up-and-coming young man. He had bought a lot of brick and stone and lumber, and he was going to build a nice new house for a young gentleman of his stature in the community. Well, when the armies reached that part of Virginia, they stole most of his building materials, bought the rest, impoverished the family. He eventually got run out of town. He lost everything he had there. It was a very traumatic event for that family. Their experience was not unusual, but because they were individual people, their experience was unique to them. This is also a love story. George Berlin was a very romantic man, and he wrote love letters to his wife while he was in the convention. Actually, sitting there writing a love letter to his wife while ex-president John Tyler was reporting to the convention on the failure of the peace conference that was supposed to save the Union in March of 1861. His wife wrote to him frequently, sitting up late at night in a cold room without a fire in the middle of the winter, long, long, long love letters. So this has an extra dimension. A love story in the Civil War was not a unique thing. But we have their letter. We can listen to their ideas. We can hear them explain their problems. We can hear them explain their hopes for their children, their worries about her brothers, one of whom was a Newmarket cadet, as a matter of fact. These people were involved in events of great consequence. What makes me interested in this for more than any other one thing is seeing how it affected the individual persons. She was out in Western Virginia. He was back in Eastern Virginia. She was having to manage everything. She was having to fend off the people who claimed he owed them money. She had to try to collect debts that people owed him money. She had to take care of the children. Like most white Virginians, they were not slave owners. But like many white Virginians, they leased slaves. They had a man who worked for them in the garden and did odd jobs and drove a wagon for them to earn them some money. They either hired young white girls or they rented black women to do household work. I mean, here's Susan Berlin out there in Western Virginia all by herself. She's got five children younger than 12. She needed help. One of her sisters actually moved in with them and became a domestic servant during part of this time. It's hard to imagine, you know, one person managing five children and running a household and dealing with everything else all at once. But she had to do that, and that's what happened in the Civil War. Happened to a lot of families. Lucky for Susan, she and her husband were eventually reunited. That's not the case in many families. Many people went off to war and never came back. And then the agony and the difficulties and the expense and the personal drama continued in many cases for the rest of their lives, for decades and decades. It's instructive to look at this episode in American history, the Civil War, at a what we call a micro history level, at the individual level of one family or of one person, because every person's experience is unique. Everyone has his or her own little world that we live in the middle of. We're lucky to have the Civil War manuscripts that we do. I think the Civil War is by far the best documented war up to that time in world history. The amount of writing people did is astonishing. The amount of material that survives is astonishing. It allows us to look at this experience. We can't look at the Revolutionary War this way. There's just not enough this kind of material. I think all you have to do is go to the library and look at the shelf that contains books on the Civil War, and you will see how people have taken advantage of this. We couldn't have that many books if we didn't have this writing. It was a pretty literate culture by then, at least among the middling and upper classes. We can see these people as individuals. We can see them as actors on the human stage. We can see them as victims of events that they had no control over. But they also did have control over many aspects of their personal and family lives. And someone like George Berlin, who was a pretty ordinary small-town lawyer, he got elected to the Virginia Convention to help Virginia decide what to do when Virginia's convention was trying to save the Union after the failure of John Tyler's peace conference. Here's a man who had never been in politics before, who was fairly ordinary, and suddenly he's in a very extraordinary place trying to save his country. It's very dramatic. He writes about this to his wife frequently in the other parts of the letters that are not love letters, about what a great responsibility he feels and about how he's afraid they will fail, but he's hopeful at the same time that they will succeed. That was his personal human drama during the secession crisis. Then after the war begins, he decides to side with the South in spite of everything, and he's a refugee. He knows many other people from Western Virginia who are refugees in the Shenandoah Valley. So he forms a body of people out there, and they look out after each other. They have little property that they brought with them. They were able to save very little in many instances. But they formed their own community, and it's whenever possible, they exchange letters with family members who remained back in the West. The family members back there were, of course, eager to hear what was going on. In the case of this family, they lost everything in the West. Eventually, Susan Berlin and the children were able to get through the lines and join George in the Shenandoah Valley. And they started all over again there, almost 40 years old, starting over as they had when they married in the Shenandoah Valley in the 1840s. The personal value the value of reading the personal letters of these people tells us things about the Civil War experience that large-scale studies, which are fascinating and extremely valuable, which large-scale studies do not. I see I've about used up my time, so if I have any time left, Mr. Speaker, I yield it to Will.
Thank you, Brent. So my story would be a little bit broader, the one that I'll tell today. When you title a book and the first word is excommunicated, it doesn't promise to be necessarily the happiest of stories. But today is St. Patrick's Day, and we should have something positive to hear about today. So I'm going to talk about a positive and yet very much unknown aspect of the Civil War, especially of the Catholic experience of the Civil War, which doesn't have a lot of books on those bookshelves that Brent mentioned earlier. What I'm going to talk about today is the 600 to 700 Catholic religious sisters, nuns, who served as nurses on either side of the American Civil War. 20% of all Catholic sisters in the United States at the time served as nurses, and they comprised 20% of all the women who served as nurses. And yet we don't hear anything about them. If you read histories of women in the Civil War, they're invisible. If you read something like James McPherson's wonderful battle cry, Freedom, you don't see them at all. And so I'm going to talk about their unlikely story today of how they came to serve in that war. And it wasn't inevitable that they would put themselves out there and take that risk to go beyond their convent walls to help poor, suffering, dying Confederate and Union soldiers. The United States had a long history of suspicion of nuns and of convents going back to the antebellum period. For example, in 1834, Lyman Beecher, who was a very prominent minister at the time, gave a rather incendiary sermon in Boston, which unfortunately had the effect of leading to a riot and a mob going to the local convent, the Ursuline Convent in nearby Charleston, and burning it to the ground in 1834. 2 years later, a book that a lot of us probably have never heard of or have forgotten, The Awful Disclosures of Maria Monk, was published. And this book was, many people consider it to be the second bestseller of the antebellum period after Uncle Tom's Cabin. And why did we not know about it? Well, it was a book that civilized society would not be proud to have read. It is basically a story, a complete fabrications story about the life of this woman who was supposedly a nun and of all the horrible, awful things that happened in her convent. It's basically a work of pornography in many ways. Unfortunately, although it sold well and a lot of people believed it, it was a complete hoax. And it was exposed as a hoax very shortly after its publication What the problem was is that the damage had already been done. And this kind of portrayal of sort of the sin and depravity that is going on behind convents, people just sort of assumed, non-Catholics assumed this was standard, sort of standard fare. So nuns, I've read many letters from nuns where they're traveling on trains and they say, it's a good thing that I wasn't wearing my habit today because the last time I did, I was verbally, physically abused and spat upon. So there's not really a lot of love for nuns in the wake or sort of in the lead up to the Civil War. Now this changes a little bit thanks to the Crimean War. You all may have heard of Florence Nightingale, of course, and the example that she set for people like Clara Barton during the Civil War, but also very important to that cause were about 20 Sisters of Mercy, Irish nuns that went and served and helped Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, whatever, soldiers in the British Army. And so this got the idea in people's heads that when the Civil War broke out a few years later in 1861, that maybe there is some use for this group of women. And in fact, they were the only group of women in the United States at the time who had any kind of formal training in nursing. They were the only ones who had that expertise, and local government officials realized this and recognized this by asking them to serve in very large numbers. I've already cited the 600 to 700 figure, which is a quite substantial figure, 20% of all women who served as nurses during the Civil War. There were two hospitals just down the road in Richmond that were served primarily by the Daughters of Charity. The Daughters of Charity is a religious community that's based out of Emmitsburg, Maryland, and over 300 of its members went all across the Confederacy and the North to basically help wherever their help was needed. Unfortunately, this led a lot of people to accuse them of being spies because nobody could really believe that in this period of Civil War that you could be so apolitical as to not care which soldiers you were serving. And in fact, the nuns would seek out prisoners in the North or prisoners in the South, most famously in the South in Charleston, and they would serve them because nobody else would, which was a good thing because we all know that prisoners during the Civil War were not very well treated by either side. This had the effect of undermining this negative conception of Catholicism in the Civil War, and I want to read just briefly from a letter that talks about this. This is from the Surgeon General of the Union Army, William Hammond, to Abraham Lincoln. And he says, "Dear sir, I have the honor to acknowledge the receipt of your letter of the 13th instant relative to the proportion to be maintained between Catholic and Protestant nurses. I think it is a fact that the Catholic nurses predominate. This is because we found in the Sisters of Charity, which is an order of nuns, a corps of faithful, devoted, and trained nurses ready to administer to the sick and wounded. No such organization exists among the Protestants of this country, and those whom we have employed cannot compare in efficiency and faithfulness with the Sisters of Charity." And then he said, "I am a Protestant and therefore cannot be accused of partiality." And he goes on to sing their praises through the rest of the letter. But let me skip to what the effect of this was after the Civil War. Well, there's sea change of how Americans see Catholicism, but nuns are held in much higher regard. In 1874, there is a monument that is dedicated to Abraham Lincoln at his final resting place in Springfield, Illinois. And all kinds of local dignitaries, U.S. Grant is there, Sherman is there, everybody's there. And the two women who are selected to unveil the monument at the end of the ceremony are Catholic nuns. Something completely unthinkable from back in the day when the ideas of Maria Monk characterized how most Americans thought of religious sisters. In 1924, various Catholics came together to build a monument that you can actually see. If you go south of DuPont Circle today to what used to be the old St. Matthew's Cathedral, there's a monument there dedicated to their service. So it's certainly a monument that is inadequate to what they did, considering all the prejudice they faced before the war, but it's a wonderful story, and for some of the more particulars about the individuals, I encourage you to read the book. Thank you.
Here, I guess. obviously have a very bad cold. At least I'm getting over it, but the residue getting to me, so I appreciate your indulgence and the medical care being exhibited toward me today. I'm here not to honor a two-volume work I did. I didn't write it. But I want to recognize and pay respects to the most extraordinary diarist probably in American literature, certainly in Civil War literature, perhaps in all of American history. The Civil War was the first time in American history where large numbers of individuals began to record their observations. The Civil War was so big, the momentous events were so swirling in this new unknown world of fighting that things needed to be remembered. And hundreds of people began keeping journals, which was a long-going American habit until television and computers came down the road. Now, the longest, most revealing, most valuable, most quoted of all Civil War diaries was John B. Jones' A Rebel War Clerk's Diary, published by J.B. Lippincott in Philadelphia in 1866. Jones was a Maryland journalist and novelist. That's important to keep in mind. He knew how to write, he knew how to report, he knew how to observe, and of course, being a novelist, he knew how to fill up the holes, if necessary, in his narrative. He was in Baltimore, he was a Marylander, he went south at the outbreak of war. He was one of the very, very few Americans of his day who saw this as a long-going, momentous struggle, not a one-battle, six-month affair. And he, as a journalist, wanted to be in the middle of it, and he wanted to record it for posterity. He had contacts, and time doesn't permit me to tell you how. He had strong contacts with President John Tyler and former Governor Henry Wise, and they got him a job in the War Department, the Confederate War Department. He was literally at the heart of the Confederate government. He saw Jefferson Davis regularly, talked often with Lee, conversed and conferred with cabinet members. He was everywhere and anywhere in the Confederate hierarchy. And his diary is indispensable for a number of things, and I need to restate them because the diary has had a strange history. It was published in 1866, August of 1866. John B. Jones was dead. He had died in February of that year. It came out in two volumes, 882 pages of very small print. And it was entitled A Rebel War Clerk's Diary at the Seat of the Confederate Government. It did not sell well at all for two reasons. One, the North didn't give a hoot on what a Southerner had to say about the war day by day. This was a victorious time. Secondly, the South couldn't afford to buy it, the book. Firstly and secondly, under that category, Jones's observations of the Confederacy were hardly going to make you stand up and sing Dixie. He was highly critical of the government in which he had been had played such a prominent part during the war years. And so the diary quickly disappeared. And it was early in the 1900s when we got the generation of great historians, James Ford Rhodes and others, that suddenly Jones's diary popped up. And since the early 1900s, to any serious student of the Civil War, that diary is indispensable. You, and I will repeat this, you literally cannot study any aspect of Confederate history in general, Virginia Confederate history in particular, and Richmond history specifically, without consulting J.B. Jones. As you almost have to go into the Bible to see what he has to say about things. And it was just an incredible diary, and I'm going to give you a half a dozen reasons why. One, Jones was in his 50s when the war came. He did not have that bubbling, innocent youth of Sally Brock Putnam and, to a degree, Murray Chestnut. He was not enamored by the glamour or romance of the war. He saw it as a long, hard, bloody contest, and he could write with wisdom, one of the few men of his day who did so. Secondly, he records something every day of the war. There's no gap, as so often appears in Mary Chestnut's diary, because she was getting over a drug addiction, not self-imposed, but whenever she got very ill, they plied her with opium, and she'd have to come down from it. So she goes for long periods of time with no interest. Jones is there every day of the war. Thirdly, he never left the city of Richmond. He was there before Fort Sumter. He was there when the city fell to Union hands. And he was a constant spectator to men and events in a swollen, bustling city that was literally the heart of the Confederate States. And he saw the war from a central pinnacle. He's right in the middle of it, sitting up in the tower, looking out. He could tell you about secret closed conferences, conversations being held between high-ranking people, both civilian and military. He hobnobbed with the elite. He argued with Jefferson Davis on occasion. He's a high-ranking war clerk. And Gary Gallagher and I, we knew in a close friendship today, we both agreed he probably had a supervisory capacity because I don't think he had time to work full-time and keep this diary. The diary is too lengthy for that. I think he had a bunch of minions underneath him, and he's looking at them every now and then as he's scrawling his daily entry. He was a man who reported not only facts, he gloried in gossip, rumors, street talk. All of that appears in his diary. You see the mood of the Confederacy in every day, from the high optimism in 1861, and you watch Jones take it down as morale slips away to absolutely panic and chaos at the end. He was great at personal observations. He had that genuine journalistic ability to summarize a man in words. He spoke of one Secretary of War, whose name I will leave unsaid, as being a man who looked like a cadaver dug up after a month's interment. So, you know, he could be very pointed, very slanted about things. He had many, many biases, especially difficult to handle. It was his anti-Semitism. Now, of course, anti-Semitism was ever present in the mid-19th century, but Jones was sort of an extra specialist at it. And something would go wrong economically, he blamed the Jews for it. But he was anti-Yankee, anti-Republican, anti-Catholic, just about anti-everything, which makes his diary a joy to read because you see opinion back and forth, and we are now so controlled by opinion, so controlled by emotion, and that's all I'm going to say about the 2016 election. He had a clear view of the strife involved here, and he was frustrated as the war went on and the government crumbled. Jones would not have liked Gone with the Wind. He wouldn't have believed it. He never saw the Confederacy as a land of magnolia and moonlight and beautiful women. Nothing like that. He saw it for what it was, a government that started shakily and then fell apart. At one point, he made a simple entry: never before did such little men rule over such great people. And this was quite characteristic of him. But he also included little things. He talked a lot about inflation, because Richmond turned into just a chaotic metropolis. It went from 38,000 people in 1860 to 300,000 by 1862. And inflation just went out of sight. And Jones was hungry for most of the war. Most Richmond city citizens were hungry. And this hunger produced such a state that at one point in January 1865, Jones said, "I think I'm starving to death." And it was a statement, just an expression. That was true. He was sick and hungry most of the time. He reports weather, which we don't hear much about. And so you know what the weather's like outside. He grew a little garden and kept you appraised of the agricultural success and failure of it as he went on. And then there are always the personalities that he describes for you. Late in 1864, he began to feel very, very ill. And Civil War medicine is one of my sort of specialties, and I conferred with a couple of physician friends who agreed with me. Well, I certainly agreed with them, let me put it that way. But I think probably his immune system just failed. Living amid poverty, filth, insufficient food, etc., Jones fell victim to a bacterial disease then called poor people's disease, tuberculosis. And there's no question that it was TB that he got. He wasn't aware of it. He knew he was coughing a lot. He knew he was weak, and there were days when he just didn't feel good, but he kept on working. And he finished the diary when Richmond fell. He escaped arrest by Union officials by going to the eastern shore of Virginia. He had married a Custis girl, the same from the same tree as Martha Custis. and he hid out there until friends back in New Jersey invited him to come, and he went to stay with them his remaining days. It sounds almost blasphemous to say it might have been well that Jones left the diary and died before he could work on it. But J.B. Lippincott, one of the leading publishers of the time, wanted to publish it. And so Jones quickly tried to work on it and bring it up to snuff, get it polished. It's already, you know, stuck about this high of papers. But he kept adding things to it. It's a process we call interpolation, where you go through and add little goodies. And Jones wasn't up to it. He was too weak. The facts were not clear in his head. He was suffering and suffering painfully from a terminal disease. And he should have left it alone, because he makes just enough mistakes of facts in his interpolations to raise a question about the diary. And that question has been a lingering one. But I think I put it to rest in the editing of the diary. I had worked on this diary about 15 years. Like all other historians, I saw what was wrong with it. Here are 880-plus pages, but you never know who is who and what is what. He followed the Victorian example, followed the Victorian habit of citing people by initials, ST, or just a blank, and that's all you knew about them. He might say, we received reports this morning of a sharp contest in Southwest Virginia. Well, you don't know what that sharp contest was, what difference it had, what its impact was. And so in editing the diary, you have to go through line by line by line and point out STD may be somebody, the blank stands for so-and-so. The sharp little contest was a June 15th fight in Whitwell, Virginia, involving so-and-so. And you just do that. And it took 15 years because it gets boring after about doing five pages. So you just sit back and you plug on and on and on. And at the end of that time, and this is not a tribute to my labor as it is to Jones's all-inclusiveness, the new printing has 2,700 footnotes. 2,700. Depicting, telling who is who and what is what. He just missed nothing. The diary, the early editions of the diary, absolutely unusual. There's no index. You don't know where to look. If he liked Jefferson Davis, you don't know it unless you want to sit there patiently going through 800 pages trying to find a citation. So I do my own indices. I always have, insist on it. I have a colleague, Jack Davis at Virginia Tech, who still boils at a book he did in which it was professionally indexed. And Jeb Stuart is mentioned four times in the index. Stuart J.E.B., Stuart Jeb, Stuart James E., and Stuart something else. Four times the same man appears in the index. So I've always insisted on doing my own. And I have indexed this thing fully. Not only names, but events and subjects. You want to know about inflation. You want to know about gossip in downtown Richmond. You want to know about weather, food, desertion in the armies, things like that. It's in the index. And the University Press of Kansas took it on. It was an expensive, monumental thing to do. But Jones's diary is now in a usable and very valuable edition. Until I got into it, Jones, I would say, was certainly in the top 10 reference books on Confederate history. It may be the top 10 in Civil War history. But now that we have a diary that's usable, it's got an index, it's got citations to identify what he said, I think the diary will be in the top five of the books absolutely indispensable to this Southern history. If you want to know something about any aspect of the Confederacy, sooner or later, to use the old quote, you've got to see what Jones said about it. And you will be able to now that these two volumes are out. It's a classic diary. I don't think there's anything like it in American history. Now that I look back, I wouldn't do it all over again. Now that I look back, I'm proud of it. I think at long last, this lonely, isolated man who spent his last months fighting for air, trying to finish this diary, I would be proud of it too. I discovered a photograph of Jones that's in the is the frontispiece of one of the volumes. And it was taken literally days before he died, and he's sitting in a chair with a towel in his lap, and you can clearly see the blood smears on the towel as he's coughing his life away. And he's a man who looks at you as if to say, I hope you like it. And I think historians I know like it, and I hope you'll find it useful and valuable as well. Thank you.
Now it's time to hear from you all. So who would like to break the ice and ask the first question?
George, would you mind introducing the people? Because I know Professor Robinson, but I didn't understand who I was listening to. Did you introduce him before?
I did, and you weren't paying attention. You're not going to pass the test. Brent Tarter from the Library of Virginia is at the far end. Bud Robertson, and Will Kurtz, who runs the Now Center for the Study of the History of the American Civil War, right here in this building, is on this end.
My question then is for Mr. Kurtz. I get the diocese newspaper from Richmond, and sometime within the last 4 years or so, when everybody was celebrating reliving the war, the diocese had a picture of Sisters of Charity, in about 25 of them, a picture of them. And they had these great big white hats on with wings. All 25 sisters had those wings on their hats. And I couldn't figure out for the life of me how anybody could be working with the sick people with these wings of hats.
The soldiers who'd never seen that before were frightened. They literally said, are you a man or a woman? What are you? And they were, first of all, they vaguely knew they were Catholic, so they needed to be on their guard. But it is really remarkable that they did wear their coronets. The Daughters of Charity especially had pretty prominent ones. And not all nuns had that sort of elaborate headgear, but yes, they were very insistent on living as if they were in the convent, wearing their same religious garb and all that. All that heavy wool, you know, packed into these very tight hospitals, some hospitals on ships. It was very... Yes. They quickly found that the male orderlies, who were basically soldiers who were recovering in the hospitals, they kind of got drafted into being nurses in many hospitals in the north and the south, and they realized that they didn't have the highest standards of cleanliness. So these women came in and really shook things up a bit. Not everybody liked that, but it was definitely necessary.
Who's next? Don't be intimidated. We're all friends. Professor Barron?
No, he did not. He stayed at war with Assistant Secretary Keene, whose diary the University Press of Virginia published. Keene was his immediate superior, and Jones and Keene didn't get along together. They were both strong-willed, aggressive, highly opinionated men. But no, he had no close friends. He was devoted to his wife. He had four children. His wife, Frances Custis, was of some means. So I think she kept them out of starvation. His salary was only $3,000 a year at a time when a bushel of corn was about $1,000. So you see, it was just a no-win situation back then. And much like John Quincy Adams, I think Jones's diary became his closest friend. He confided everything into it. And strangely enough, the thing I found most lacking was he said a little about slavery. Never mentioned the subject one way or the other. He did mention it once. He mentioned what a travesty it was to see the dozen black troops that the Confederacy authorized march around Capitol Square in March. It was March 1865 when they went around Capitol Square. He just thought this was a travesty with everybody involved. So his opinions really just give juice to this thing. But the inclusiveness of it, I just can't overstress. He was a journalist. He had edited newspaper. So he subscribed to all four of the Richmond papers, and he copied down stories from them so that you don't have to do research in the newspapers. You just use Jones for the real good news because he's quoting them. He, I think, would take home official reports and correspondence and copy them down and bring them back the next day and put them in place, never knowing that beginning in the 1880s, the federal government would start publishing all this official material, and it would end up 128 volumes, which we all call the official records of the Union and Confederate armies. But Jones was writing from the originals, and there's some real grammatical differences between Jones's version and what the government edited in its version. So, again, it's just another appetizer for his diary. The more I worked with it, the more amazing I became. I'm amid the boredom sometimes, just trying to find out things. And hunting down all those folks was just excitement. He mentioned an SMD, who he said was a wealthy Vicksburg merchant. Well, I tried everything I knew to find SMD's name, and I couldn't. But I had in my files, because I do Mississippi Civil War cruises a lot, the name of a guy who has a little museum in Vicksburg, and his name is Bubba. So I wrote Bubba and asked if he knew an SMD. Well, I got this page and a half back about SMD. He was a successful merchant in Vicksburg. So you track stuff down that way. I am paranoid about middle names. I'll break a back to find a middle name. And so the diary is full of full names of these individuals. But I think to answer your question again, his diary was his closest friend.
Yes, sir.
To the panel, what more could you tell us about our own Confederate museum here on the grounds at the cemetery? And it seems amazing that 1,200 mostly Confederates are buried in that small walled area at Alderman and McCormick. And I wonder if they were only not direct battlefield dead, but only ones that died in hospital in the cemetery?
Well, they died here in the Charlottesville hospitals. Yeah, this was a great medical center. Yeah, none of those are battle casualties directly. They died of wounds or sickness. Because wounds and sickness will kill every two men from one man killed in action. And there were no fighting around here in Charlottesville, though Jones reported a spirited action at Scottsville that took place at one point in the Civil War. No, they died at the hospital. They could be. On the other hand, there may not be if the stone. I haven't seen the cemetery recently. If the stones are in place, are perfectly aligned and whatnot, they're probably misaligned. Because they dump them in there pretty regularly. They're buried in that mass graves, I would estimate, if they die of a plague or something of that sort.
Then on the listing of them by state, Virginia is not the most populated of the dead. I think North Carolina is. Would that be likely because families came here and picked up?
Are you asking a Virginian to answer that question? I can't say.
It may be a function of which units were in this vicinity when people got ill or people got wounded. There were units from every state in almost every part of Virginia at one time or another. And there are burial grounds all over the place, and I suspect that Bud Robertson is right that in some instances, if a serious disease went through a camp or a hospital, that there are mass graves with lots of people thrown in, no dignity, no time for that, no space for that, no one to do the work.
Especially in the heat of summer.
Yes.
Decomposition begins very, very quickly.
But would you share with this group what you did many years ago at a book festival here about the home mail delivery?
I give a talk called How the Civil War Still Lives, showing how it affects your life. And you can't believe how it affects your life. If you don't like the Civil War, you better leave America, because much of your life is that. There was a quartermaster general who didn't like the fact that one uniform was issued to soldiers of all shapes and fashions. And so he ordered all uniform makers in the North to make four uniforms, small, medium, large, extra large. Everything you have on is pre-sized. Everything. Everything you wear, in a sense, came out of the Civil War. The Postal Service back at the time of the Civil War, delivered mail twice a week. I mean, it was at the post office. You went there and collected your mail. And increasingly, as the war years passed, more and more women were receiving letters that their sweethearts, their husbands, their brothers, sons, would not be coming home. They were killed or had died. And so the post office quickly became the local wailing wall. You went to the post office, there you got the news, there you bawled like a baby. And after a while, the Postal Service became embarrassed. This, we don't want the post office to be the wailing wall of the county or something to that effect. So in 1864, the Postal Service found a solution to the problem. What is it? Home delivery of mail. That mailbox beside your door, or that mailbox out on the post that you're curbing, is really a memorial to a Civil War soldier. I hope you'll remember that.
Ma'am?
I used everything I had, but it's by no means complete. There's an entire 6 month period where none of his letters to her survive. There's another 6 month period where none of her letters to him survive. And in fact, her very first letters to him in February of 1861 do not survive because the mail coach was robbed between Buchanan and Clarksburg. This is not uncommon in the time. Someone would hold up the stagecoach, takes the mail, take all the money out of the letters, and throw everything else away. And so her first letters to him while he was off on convention are missing. And there are references, she wrote him two letters right after New Year's Day, 1862. One survives. He mentions both of them when he replied. So I wish we had those other letters. It would fill in some very, very large gaps. I tried to fill in the gaps as best I could by reading other people's mail. There's a couple of nice diaries from her hometown. There's almost no newspaper coverage of that part of Western Virginia early in the Civil War. But you can see what's going on in the next county, make some educated suppositions about what was going on where she was, and so you fill in the gaps. It's not unlike annotating the diary, explaining who's who and who's what, because if husband and wife are writing letters to each other, they'll mention E.J. Coleridge. Well, they both knew who that was. I didn't. He was a merchant, former mayor, and a shoemaker. So you have to figure out who these people are and what they're going on. You fill in the gaps that you best you can, so that their incomplete file of letters tells their story for them. Just as soon as the Virginia Convention voted to secede, the U.S. mail stopped operating in Virginia. So the letters that they were able to exchange throughout this entire period are letters that they wrote and gave to somebody when they knew that somebody was going to try to make it through the lines. And so some of those letters are lost, too. She tells a story about taxing one of their friends who went from Eastern Virginia to Western Virginia, and he carried a whole packet of letters for various people. He was afraid he would get captured and get in trouble for carrying the letters, so he destroyed them. This was very personal. There was no post office operating across the army lines then.
Going back to your original question, in a lifetime of doing research in Civil War letters, I think where we are glaringly missing are letters from her to him. Because the soldier tended one of two things. First, he would destroy the letter immediately because it was a very private thing to him. Society then was a far cry from society now, and that's why I sort of chuckle at PC people who want us to follow modern-day morality when we don't have any, rather than going back to the morality of Civil War time. So the letter might be too personal, he'd tear it up. Or else, and I've seen this, he would open it and read it, close it, open, read, close, open, until the letter literally fell apart. And so correspondence from her is the most valuable source we have, or we need, in Civil War history. His letters, the family, of course, lovingly preserved, but her letters don't survive very often.
This may be one reason why historians take so much interest in the women's diaries, mm-hmm. because this is where you get the home front news.
Yes.
The very, very important part of the history of the period that is not on the battlefield. You know, this is where we learn about the women and the children and the old folks.
Sir?
This might be a naive question, but the journals and the letters and all types of correspondence, where do you guys find that? And is there still new stuff coming out? And if so, is this auctioned off, or how is it distributed to historians?
You find it at archives, at the libraries. A lot of it's in personal hands. I'm so old, people just send me stuff, you know, thinking I'm ready to be sent to the home anyway. I would enjoy reading it. So you figured that all along. You just search for it. When I did the Jackson book, I wrote to 276 depositories, libraries, historical society, asking if they had any material on Stonewall Jackson. I always kind of felt like maybe a half dozen would come in. 92 had stuff, including the Maine Historical Society, which had a letter from him. And the recent sesquicentennial. I'm so proud to have been a member of that body by legislative appointment. We, Virginia, were the sesquicentennial. No other state did anything compared to us. We did it all. One of the things we did was called the Legacy Project. We had two photographic teams come around the state. They traveled all 100 counties, all 34 cities, and they would announce well in advance they were coming. And what they asked for was for people who had diaries and letters in their own private hands to lend them to us just long enough to film. All we want to do is make a copy for the state library. We thought we might get 1,000 pages. We got 31,200 pages of material. It'll blow your mind. It's blown my mind because the Speaker of the House adroitly named a collection of me and then said, write a book about it. So I just finished doing this little book about it. And the material's out there. There's no question about that. It's simply bringing it forward. Will we learn anything breathtakingly new? No, I don't think so. But we'll learn something emotionally and humanly and individually. And I've spent a lifetime teaching college students that you'll never understand the Civil War unless you understand its emotions. Its emotions. These people were emotionally out of control. We were too young a nation to have wisdom. So we let our emotions guide us. And the emotions of the 1850s are indicative. We were arguing, we were debating, we started shouting, and it's that far from shouting to shooting. And you take the 1850s, as I'm going to do next week in Appomattox, and just go through the 1850s, and you'll see this emotion take place. We lost the will to compromise. Everybody's talking, nobody's saying anything. We're shouting at one another, not looking for a solution, but just let everybody know how we think. And the nation fell apart. And history can repeat itself. Believe it, history can.
This is a very valuable discussion. And for those of you who are inspired and want to leave here and do something meaningful for the collection of history, almost all of us today carry in our pockets cell phones. And they all have got, generally for free, a scanning app. And when you're traveling around, if you run into anybody who says they have Civil War memorabilia of any kind, correspondence, you know, anything that may have escaped the dragnet that Bud Robertson and them put out some years ago, pull out your cell phone and take a picture of it. And, you know, make sure it goes to the Virginia State Library or to the Special Collections here or any of the repositories around the state that really after this. This is a way for lay people, for individuals who are just history buffs to, you know, make a very important and positive contribution. So thanks very much for raising that question. Yes,
I could add to what Bud just said. The State Library has scanned all of these documents, and they are available online. You could probably look at them on your phone right now. Go to the Library of Virginia's website, Virginia Memory Digital Collections, and you'll find these however many hundred and some odd thousand pages of Civil War documents, virtually none of which had ever been seen outside of the family that owned it. It includes documents from every state. It includes documents about events of the Civil War in nearly every state, not just Virginia. These happen to be documents that were in Virginia at the beginning of the commemoration. So it's a fantastic project. If you own any legislators, if you own any members of the legislature, get them to do something similar for the commemoration of the centennial of World War I before this stuff disappears.
Yes, ma'am.
I did that. I took the letters that I had, and my family was half in Indiana and half across the Ohio River. But Dr. Robinson, you never. How would you describe Mary Chestnut's diaries that everybody quotes as compared to, of course, she's a woman and she's sitting in her own home, to Jones?
Well, Mary Chestnut, and obviously this is non-debatable, we know this, she'd taken a lot with that diary. She worked on it and worked on it and rewrote it and did many, many things to it. And there are a number of editions of the diary, and it's not always the same diary that you're reading. So really, how much of it she actually wrote, what she really included originally, we don't know. But she was seeing war from the high society level. Jones is seeing war from down in the ditches, down in the poor man's section. And I'm biased, I'm sure. I've got too much of my life invested in him, but I think he's far more revealing, certainly far more reliable. Oh, Murray was a gossip of the first order, and she too often passes off personal belief for facts.
Yes, ma'am.
Would you repeat where we go when we go to the Library of Virginia Memory?
For the scans of the letters that were collected, the Library of Virginia's website, lva.virginia.gov.
If you want to look at what we did, it's listed under the literary project,
yep.
A legacy project, legacy project. Just push in Library of Virginia legacy project.
I'd like to ask Dr. Robertson a really simple-minded question, but that's about all I can do. How does one attack a two-volume diary? How should those of us who are not specialists in Civil War history attack this? Should we sit down and read it start to finish like we would a good novel, or should we use the index and pick out titles that we're interested in?
No, I just started with page one, line one, and on 5x8 cards, and put down the questions, the things he said it needed answering, and then go all through it, and then thereafter, It was just slave labor. Virginia Tech has on microfilm the Fort Richmond newspaper. So I went through each one of them, knowing full well that Jones was reading it too, and picked up a lot of place when he mentions, for example, one of the newspapers severely criticized Jefferson Davis. I could go back to that April 6th or 7th date and find that Richmond Examiner was letting Davis have it. So it's just tedious. It's really tedious. But it needed to be done. In all my professional career, I kept saying, I wish somebody would do something with Jones. And Gary Gallagher and I were talking today. He said, I've been saying the same thing all my career. I wish somebody would do something with Jones. So back in the late 80s, I guess, I just said, by golly, I'm going to do it. And I got sidetracked often doing other works. But it was good to get away from that diary. It's just so detailed. I just don't understand. I really don't. How this man could see so much, remember so much, write down so much. But being a journalist, he had that eye and he had that ear, professionally trained, and he just picked it up. And the diary, as Georgia very nicely said, the diary is a lovely thing to read. It's kind of fun to read it because you see all of his biases creeping out. It kind of reminds you of what's happening with Donald Trump. He's kind of letting it all hang out, you know, at times. Really going after it, saying how he felt. And I think he probably, in many respects, suffered from Jefferson Davis's fatal illness. He loved the Confederacy to such an extent. He just couldn't imagine that it was going to die, that it was dying from such incompetence and extortion and speculation and inflation. It was self-destructing. And he, like the president, was helpless to stop it. So that's a long way to answer.
I wondered if I might ask Will a question, since we were on the subject of letters and sources. I haven't yet had a chance to see your book. I'm very eager to read it. What were the primary sources for the experiences of the nurses? Did you have letters or diaries or church records that recorded their experiences?
They didn't keep many of their letters from the war, actually. I'm not sure why that is, but they did. They had to kind of justify what they were doing because there were a lot of, some of the Catholic authorities didn't think it was necessarily proper for them to be out nursing to men, especially nuns that had no experience with nursing. Many of those who actually served were teachers, basically. So they wrote long, detailed accounts shortly after the war of what they were doing, justifying what they were doing and why it was important. And in those accounts, you see again and again that it's, you know, it's about living out their faith and showing what their faith is to non-Catholics. And then they also, of course, when they happen to find the 1,000th soldier who was never baptized, they, you know, they record all the baptisms that they do very faithfully. That was something that was very important to them, especially when a soldier was on sort of the verge of death. It was really important that they do that according to their faith tradition. They were noticed at the time by William Sherman was related to a nun from a school very close to the, what became the University of Notre Dame, and he often pulled a lot of strings to make sure that they would be employed even when some officials didn't want them there. Dorothea Dix, for example, hated the nuns, didn't want anything to do with them, and tried to basically bar them from a lot of the hospitals in the West, but Grant and Sherman stepped in and basically said, tough, you're going to take them. And I think it was fortunate for the soldiers that that happened. But there's not a lot of commentary necessarily from the larger community at the time, but they are depicted in Harper's Weekly. They're depicted there serving on what was a novelty at the time, a U.S. Navy hospital boat. And so this was very extraordinary. And so Harper's Weekly wanted to know more about it, and there they were. So it was a lot of these sort of just after the war, post-war accounts that were useful for me.
This is the way historians do. We always talk about our sources, you know. Where else can I find good stuff?
Yeah.
The Festival of the Book is free of charge, but not free of costs. So please either pick up a envelope at the back and do just like you do at church, put a little money in and leave it in. Or we have moved into the 21st century, go online and make a contribution that way. Please fill out the program evaluation forms. Again, you can pick up a form that's sort of a yellowish form, or you can go online to virginiabook.org and complete the form online. Please buy the books. The authors will be signing copies as soon as we dismiss the class. And finally, please join me in giving thanks to our sponsor, the Now Center for the Study of the American Civil War.